Welcome, everyone. Today is May 16, 2017. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We have an informational meeting today on the budget of DHS. And last time we met, we had a budget hearing on housing community services. Three of the people on this policy committee are also on the subcommittee that considers that, but no one on this policy committee is on the human services subcommittee that has a chance to really dig into your budget. So I really appreciate this opportunity for an overview. So first, can we lead off, please, with Director Clyde Seike and whoever else you would like to have up with you.
Are you going to warn him first that you want him to be, try to be as accurate as he possibly can for change?
I know, he always is.
I always agree.
He always is.
But what I tell you today, it might not be true tomorrow. So.
That's accurate, too.
Yeah. So Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Solson, and Sanchez, for the records, Clyde Seike, Department of Human Services. With me at the table is Eric Moore, who's our Chief Financial Officer. We're here today to give you an update on our budget for the upcoming biennium and to talk about some of the reductions that the subcommittee, Ways and Means Subcommittee for Human Services, has proposed. So I'm going to start by just kind of setting the context, giving a brief overview, and then I'm going to ask each of our five program directors to come up and talk about some of the proposed reductions in their areas. And then to wrap up, I really wanted to talk about some of the investments that the governor had included in her budget, because I think it's important at least to have a discussion with you about some of the areas that we had wanted to make some investment in to improve services. So some of these slides are repeats of the slides when we came in to do our overview, but I was looking back and that was in kind of early March, and so I thought it might be good just as a refresher.
I think it was February.
Oh, it was early.
I think it was like the very first day.
Yeah, well, time flies when
February 2nd.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. So just some of the factors that impact our services and our caseload. The growing population of older adults, the aging of the population, has a direct impact on our aging and people with disabilities caseload. With the implementation of the K plan or community choice plan, we've seen an increase in the number of people we're serving with physical and intellectual and developmental disabilities. We also know that the demographics of the state are changing, and we're having greater racial and ethnic diversity. We also, this I think is not a surprise to anyone, have seen a very uneven pace of recovery throughout the state from the last recession, and we see that people in the rural areas really are struggling a lot more than people in the valley and some of the more urban areas. We're also seeing that jobs are returning, but the jobs that are coming back are not the jobs that we've lost in timber and manufacturing and those types of things. They're more service industry-oriented jobs, which means kind of more uneven schedules and lower wages. And one of the issues we struggle with, and I know the committee has struggled with, is just the accessibility and cost of housing. This is one of the biggest barriers our clients face on an ongoing basis. You know, if they are lucky enough to find housing, they're not able to afford it. And so it's one of the biggest issues that the people we serve face. And, you know, every day it's kind of a guessing game of where the federal government's going to end up as far as Medicaid policy, what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act or the ACHA. I don't remember what the acronyms stand for. I should, but I don't. And, you know, really just the uncertainty on some of our other program areas of what's going to happen as far as federal policy and federal funding. So if you look at the governor's recommended budget for 17-19, our budget was proposed at $11.26 billion. Of that, as you look at the pie chart, voc rehab is about 1% of the budget, our aging and people with disabilities, 30%, Our Office of Developmental Disability Services, about 24%. Our Administrative and Shared Services, 7%. Our Self-Sufficiency Program, 28%. And our Child Welfare Program is about 9% of the budget. About 8,076 full-time equivalent employees. So I think it's important to remember that when you look at our budget, 67% of our budget is composed of federal funds, 28% general fund, and then just a smaller portion, 5% of other funds, fees, recoveries, things of that nature. So in the co-chair's plan or reduction plan, our reduction target was set at $285 million general fund, which is about an 8.7% reduction. But I think one thing that I want to make sure the committee understands is that we use a lot of general fund to also leverage federal funds. So besides the $285 million general fund, approximately $310 million of federal fund will be lost by taking a reduction of that size. So I'll stop and if anybody has any questions, be happy to answer them. And if not, we'll move on and bring up our first program.
Questions?
Okay. Thank you for that. So I'm going to ask Ashley Carson Cunningham, who's director of our Aging and People with Disabilities division, to come and join us at the table.
Yeah, before Madam Chair, if I can just jump in here really quick. Director Psyche.
Sir.
I just want to take a moment here instead of doing it, wait till the end of this presentation. Thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for all your help over the years. You have a great group of people that work around you. Your agency is easy for me to get behind and support. So I just want to say thank you.
So Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson and Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, thanks. I really appreciate that.
Ditto, and we will make sure to get a chance to get you back before the end of the session to properly thank you. But
well, I don't want to say that.
Putting a green
mark. We've already done it. That's right.
You can say it as many times as you want.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Aging and People with Disabilities Director at DHS. As you're all aware, the population is aging. Oregon has long been forward-thinking in our approach to serving older adults and people with disabilities. In Oregon, the 65-plus population is expected to grow from 645,000 in 2015 to over 1 million by 2030. The population of adults with disabilities is also growing. People receiving SSDI went from 6.5 million in 2005 to over 8 million in 2015. Our program is dedicated to innovation around serving vulnerable populations for the long term. We need to plan and prepare and use our resources very wisely as the population ages and relies more and more upon our services and supports to support their consumer choice and live where they want to live as they age, and to remain healthy, independent, and safe for the long term. Next slide, Eric. The framework put forth has $97.7 million in reductions for our program, and I'm going to highlight the impact quickly of several of those proposed reductions in the next slide. The first reduction is for our live-in service option for our in-home program. So this has been a very popular option where people with very high and critical needs wish to remain in home and were able to have one caregiver meet their needs 24/7. The caregiver would live with the individual. And due to federal changes in the Fair Labor Standards Act, that program became very expensive for us as a state because we're required to pay overtime and minimum wage for all hours worked. So we began a process of transitioning individuals from the live-in service option to the in-home hourly program. So people can still remain in-home, which is their choice, but they would have to have multiple caregivers hired to meet their needs. We've reduced that program greatly, and the recommendation is that we transition the remaining 250 or so consumers into the hourly program. The second reduction is for the complex medical add-on payment for nursing facilities. The basic rate, nursing facilities are paid a daily amount, and it's around $280 a day. The complex medical add-on rate is 40% additional of that basic rate on top of that rate. And it's to meet people's needs around more intensive medication procedures, treatment procedures, or rehabilitation services that are all listed in our administrative rules. So this would impact likely all or the majority of the 130 nursing facilities that accept Medicaid in our state, which is the majority of nursing facilities. The framework, the co-chair's framework, also recommended a $16 million reduction to the Oregon Project Independence Program. Our estimate at this point is that that would mean 1,200 people were impacted per month. In a biennium, there's about 5,000 individuals served through that program. People come on and off throughout the biennium. This program is incredibly popular and important for older adults and people with disabilities. It provides personal care, chore services, adult day, meals, and service coordination for vulnerable people who are not on our Medicaid programs. The program serves people who are 60 plus or who have an Alzheimer's diagnosis. And then in the last several years, we were able to pilot a program for adults with disabilities, so people under 60 with a disability who are not on Medicaid services to receive those same types of supports in home. It's a light touch support program that helps people remain independent and not necessarily come onto the Medicaid program. That said, a lot of the people in the program are lower income and vulnerable and at risk. The average monthly cost for Oregon Project Independence is around $332, and for Medicaid, and that's general fund, and then for Medicaid, the general fund amount for an in-home consumer is around $800. So it's a very cost-effective program. We're currently serving about 1,800 people in the older adult program and close to 300 in the program for adults with disabilities. We also have wait lists for this program. As of February, the data that we received from the Area Agencies on Aging was that there were about 1,300 people on the wait list statewide.
How many did you say right now? Not 300 with the disabilities, and how many seniors?
1,800.
Can I ask a question here?
Of course.
So the reduction is from 16 million reduced from, was it 22 million?
Chair Kenny Geyer, yes, I believe it's around 21, 22 million for the total program.
And so for any of these, can you say what that's the savings to the program, but what the impact could be financially, both in loss of federal funds or OPI people having to go into long-term care? Do you have any estimates on what this could actually cost the state of Oregon?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I don't have that estimate right now, but I know that traditionally there's a small percentage that go from OPI onto Medicaid. So about, I think it's about 30% that end up transitioning onto the Medicaid program who've been on OPI. You know, it very well could result in people then applying for Medicaid coverage and coming on to the Medicaid program. That is a real possibility.
And then on the second bullet, I'm assuming that that just means that people who are in these nursing facilities get less care to meet their needs. They're they're able to be less functional. They're still housed and fed and cared for, but maybe they can't operate at their full potential. Would that be, what would be the consequence of the second reduction?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, the individuals would still need to have their needs met.
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding is it would be a big impact to the nursing facility because they would still need to meet those people's needs that are more complex without that additional payment amount. And if they were unable to meet the person's needs, the person might have to move to a different setting type. So it could be an impact both to consumers and to our providers.
Okay. Any other questions?
Questions? Nope.
All right.
So next program, I'm going to ask Lilia Tennenty, who's the director of our Office of Developmental Disability Services, to come up.
Good morning. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennenty. I'm the director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services. Our program at this point serves about 26,000 children and adults in the state of Oregon who have an intellectual or developmental disability. Our caseload growth has expanded considerably, especially around children, with the result of the implementation of the K-Plan or the Community First Choice option that we've discussed in this hearing and I think many, many others. So at this point, we are looking at ways to encourage and support sustainability within the IDD program. This has been an ongoing discussion with our stakeholders, with legislators, with others, looking at ways that we can meet the needs of the people we're supporting effectively, but then also try to bend our cost curve, because we know we are continuing, our costs do continue to increase from biennium as a result of kids still coming into services and caseload growth and our cost per case increases. We expect ultimately, though, that we have a report that lets us, that has demonstrated that we expect caseload growth at some point to even off. We're looking at early 2019 for that, because at that point the door will have been open for long enough that everyone who's eligible, kids and adults, will be in, and at that point we'll shift to just regular attrition in and out of the program. So that's something we're focused on. We've been talking to forecasting, and they have those numbers, and at this point we're tracking pretty close to forecasting projections, so we just continue to watch that, and we'll continue to watch our caseload growth as it goes, hoping that ultimately it does slow as we are expecting, because there won't be, everyone who's in will be in, everyone who wants to be in will be in, and the caseload will just go to natural attrition. So the co-chair's targeted projections for the IDD program suggested a 56.7 million reduction, almost a 20% reduction. That's going to be very difficult to implement without significantly impacting the people we support, their families, and ultimately provider agencies, which then also impact the people that we serve and support. If you think about our caseload growth, ultimately, we've opened the door wider. Yes, that's cost more, but this would, with this reduction, we'd be looking at how we could manage the people that we're supporting now with a reduction of this size. And so some of the things that have been proposed in the co-chair's budget, historically, Oregon has had a wide door to IDD eligibility. This was a result of the Staley lawsuit settlement agreement that really set a standard for the expectation that individuals and families should expect or can expect from the state, which was we'll open the door to all adults who are eligible. We'll make that eligibility criteria broad, but then we'll provide a limited number of support and a limited amount of support. And ultimately, with the K-Plan, we kept the eligibility door broad, but we took off the cap on a limited amount of support. So what's being discussed at this point is looking at how we narrow our eligibility criteria. These numbers, the number represented here, ultimately would mean doing doing away with what we call the parental income disregard. Right now, any child who's eligible for IDD services, we look at the child's income, we disregard the parental income. So what that means is we support a lot of children in our program whose parents don't ultimately need to meet the Medicaid financial criteria in order to receive services. That was established, the precedent for that was established with the Children's In-Home Intensive Services Program in the mid-2000s, I want to say 2006, 2007. Ultimately, understanding that for a lot of families with kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities, if the support wasn't provided, they would make decisions like quitting jobs to stay home and take care of the child or doing other things that ultimately would result in them coming through the Medicaid door, through putting the family at risk, coming through the Medicaid door for other reasons because of medical bills and expenses associated with caring for the child. So Oregon established the program, the precedent with the CIS program, that when we support children with intellectual and developmental disabilities, we do so looking at their income only and not a parental income. This, based on the projections, the numbers we have right now, we expect that this would result in about 35% of the kids we serve in in-home services through the K-Plan right now losing services, losing eligibility, and therefore losing services. That's roughly 1,000 children. And I want to stress that our estimates on the eligibility pieces are rough, very rough, because we don't have, I can't go in and go do to an IT system and pull a report because we don't have a statewide case management system. So we had to do a hand count and look at other systems and other data to come up with these estimates. So I make that point to be clear that any one of these reductions around eligibility, while we did estimate an impact, it could be considerably more. It could be less. We don't know. We did the best we could with what we were able to estimate. So that's one of the reductions in the proposal to narrow eligibility. The other one that was in the co-chair's recommended or the co-chair's framework talks about increasing our level of care requirements. The federal minimum for meeting eligibility for level of care for IDD services is having 3 functional deficits, and I'm saying minimum, that's wrong. The federal government says basically to get Medicaid for people to meet level of care, it's a maximum. 3, you can't add more. A state can't say that a person must have 4 or 5 functional deficits. 3 is the maximum. Oregon, back with the Staley settlement, when they decided to do a wide door, chose to go with 2, which is appropriate. States are allowed to go less than 3. They just can't go more. And so what's being proposed here is that we increase the number of functional deficits or functional limitations required to meet IDD eligibility. We estimate that would impact about, again, 1,000 children currently receiving services and at least 600, if not more, adults. And these are people who, with eligibility changes, we can't grandfather. You can't say, okay, everybody who's in is in and continues to be in, and then we start a new way with eligibility. It's got to be everybody. So what this would require us to do, in addition to negotiating with CMS on both of these issues, is then to have everybody who potentially falls in the category of not meeting these requirements go through a new eligibility redetermination. So we could have someone in a group home who's been there for many, many years, who now we go through this eligibility redetermination process, and ultimately they lose eligibility, and then we have to help them figure out how to transition out of a group home and what might happen with their lives. So eligibility is not an easy issue to discuss. It directly impacts the people we support. And I would say at this point, based on the discussions we've had with the DD stakeholder community, it's clear that what we want for our system is we want the door to remain open wide, but we want to work really hard on containing our cost in terms of what services we're providing and how much we're providing per person. I think the fundamental, to quote the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition board, they want the pie to be cut into smaller pieces and everybody to get a piece of pie, as opposed to the pie cut in large pieces and some people not getting any.
So can I ask, with regard to that, because it sounds like you're doing not what they want. It sounds to me like you're cutting eligibility as opposed to giving less. And I thought that you could, in the CREA plan, decide not to take the higher match that said you had to expand eligibility and services, I think, but you get a higher match. So if you could refresh us on that and why you decided to go the direction you did. And also the other question related to that is, I'm assuming it's a federal requirement that when you cut eligibility, you can't grandfather people in.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I'll start with the easy answer. Yes, you are correct. It's a Medicaid requirement on eligibility that you don't grandfather. Eligibility is eligibility. You're either in or you're out. And going back to your questions about K-Plan and what's being recommended here, the DD system is in a difficult moment. There are ways to bend a cost curve in a program like this. One of them is looking at the amount we pay for services. I think you've all heard pretty clearly about the direct support professional crisis and what's happening with our provider agencies and their inability and struggle to find and retain staff. So we could, to achieve a financial fiscal direction, we could cut rates. But I think at this point that would just lead to further crisis and put more people at harm than I think is reasonable. The other thing we can do is reduce the amount of services that we're providing. We did try to do that. We worked very hard with stakeholders. We came up with a plan looking at data associated with what was being allocated in our in-home assessment process. We started the process after a very thorough review with stakeholders and, in fact, had been changing to the assessment with fewer hours for 9 months, I think, of about the full year that it was going to take to roll in when we were sued. And basically, as a result of that, we have gone back, agreed to a preliminary injunction that basically restores the higher authorized hours that people were getting and pushes us to do what we were going to do anyway, which is develop a real long-term plan, use a new assessment, look at how we're allocating hours and authorizing hours, and implement that going forward. And so we're in the process right now. I have a meeting today, actually right after this hearing, with our stakeholders and with the attorneys from Disability Rights Oregon to start talking about what that looks like because we have completed the pilot on the new assessment and we're ready to move forward with future steps. In the meantime, though, until we get that fully processed and implemented, we're in a position where pulling down in-home hours, at least from the state doing it through the assessment process or authorization process, we're in a holding pattern. So those two things that are usually on the table, provider rates and reducing services, have become difficult for us to move forward on in the immediate term. Then that leaves the third thing, which is the number of people we support, which is eligibility. And so I would say to you, this isn't a recommendation by any means. From ODDS or from our stakeholders or from DHS or anyone. This is a recognition that we're in a difficult moment. It's going to take us time to move out of that moment, either, you know, with moving into the new process that will get us back to a more person-centered, focused planning process, using the assessment as one piece of that, not driving the system by an assessment. But in the interim, when we're faced with looking at a biennial budget and request from and direction from the legislature to look at reductions, this is what's on the table for us.
So, I'm sorry.
Yep.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, I think she, Director Tennessee, talked about how we attempted to maybe, instead of eliminate people, reduce the number of hours of service, which would make hours available to other people, and she kind of glossed over that. But I think it's important for the committee for her to hear kind of what the process was and the analysis of the data they did that led them to the decision that they did, which, of course, then led to the lawsuit and us having to go back and reinstate. So I think...
Well, just because ask, and I know you have a question too, but it sounded like the stakeholder group in general wanted to share the pie in smaller slices, so not cut eligibility but cut hours. And then it sounds like you were going in that direction until the lawsuit. So maybe the lawsuit was not indicative of where the majority of stakeholders were, but the lawsuit forced you into the decision you're going, that you've come to? Is that correct?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I think...
Yeah, I asked a sticky question.
Yes. And I think we have been working with our broader stakeholders that includes representation from just every aspect of the system on sustainability now for a couple of years. And where we went with what we were calling our realignment came with extensive discussions with that group, as Director Psyche mentioned, considerable data analysis, looking at the fact that the majority of people that were getting the authorized hours were using well below what was authorized. We spliced and diced it by age, by level of need. No matter how you cut it, when we were looking at it, it was clear that what we were authorizing was above what the vast majority of people in the DD system were using. And I would say, to demonstrate that point, we had gone through the process of applying the new assessment with the reduced hours for over 6,000 individuals. In that same time, we also increased about 1,800 individuals based on different changes in need and different things. And while there had been some concerns and people had, you know, contacted us and we'd gone through, we had an exceptions process, we had appeals process, ultimately, at the end of the day, because of how the DD system rolled into the K plan with an assessment developed on an Excel spreadsheet without a lot of testing or understanding of the mechanisms behind it, we were in a position where, when faced with the lawsuit and the nature of the lawsuit, while it laid out things that we knew were issues and are working to fix with the ultimate long-term solution, this was an intermediate step that we had, and so we had to go back and undo what we did because many of the issues laid out in the lawsuit we knew existed and we had tried to address, but with how, where we were in our system, where we were in our process, our lack of ability to really dig into an Excel spreadsheet in a way that met muster, we had to undo what we had done. So I'm going to probably not talk too much more about the lawsuit because I'm not supposed to talk about it too much, but I can tell you that we're now, you know, we're working with DOJ, we've already implemented the process to restore the hours that needed to be restored. Our goal is to now shift our focus from what we had been doing with the assessment that we knew was problematic to begin with onto our longer-term fix, working with our stakeholders to develop all of the regulatory and policy and Medicaid expectations around that so that when we move into this again the next time, we'll have everyone at the table, including attorneys, and we'll be able to go forward, hopefully, with agreement from everyone that what we're doing is sound and going in the right direction.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I actually just wanted to add a little bit more context to that whole conversation. So, started in 2015, and you were in many of these conversations, and Senator Bates and myself and others sat down, and we basically said, with full knowledge of pretty much, and in agreeance with people in this building, that the assessment system that we were working or using was not working. There are critiques in, valid critiques in how it's put together. And over, and I'm repeating a lot of what she just said, you know, we were seeing, look, people are qualifying for services up to here, but they're only using this. Mm-hmm. And when you budget based off of that, you are budgeting resources in an area that you're not going to use, and it ends up throwing everything off. And I remember sitting in the Ways and Means Committee, and you were sitting, both of you were sitting next to me, as we were talking about, like, we can't keep budgeting this way. We have to change something. So there was a ton of pressure applied to the agency from the legislature to change that assessment ASAP. Mm-hmm. Now, so as Lily was just saying, my understanding, so I'm not saying this is perfect because I wasn't in every conversation, we said, well, if you need to come up with something that works for now, then come up with something that works for now, even if it's not your final solution. And I think the agency did a fantastic job of rolling that out, mm-hmm. of taking a look at how few people would actually be affected in what they were using So, but people thought that they were losing a lot more. So my office received a lot of phone calls, and we were able to take the exact documents that these guys sent out to people and say, well, you know what, if you read this, how much have you been using? Oh, you realize that it's not really actually going to change anything. And, oh, by the way, if it does, they have a fantastic exceptions process that they've built into this to try to make sure it's not necessarily grandfathering people in. It's making an exception, and there is a difference in legally what that means. And so they did a fantastic job of trying to make sure they didn't miss anyone with the new criteria. Anyway, so I personally am very disappointed that the lawsuit happened because I think it took us backward from progress that we were trying to make. So I think ultimately it put everything on hold for a little while, that we're still going to make that progress, but in the meantime we're at an awkward standstill, and I don't think the agency is to blame for that. I have plenty of things I can blame you guys for, but I don't think that's one of them.
I would have to agree with that, and I just find it incredibly sad that there are going to be people who are currently getting services who are going to be knocked off totally, particularly if they're in a group home and have to leave that. That just seems just inexcusable. So
thank you, Chair Kinigeyer. The other reductions we have would eliminate bed holds. Thank you. Bed hold is something we pay with 100% general fund, so there's no Medicaid match lost with this. The challenge for us is that the bed holds go to provider agencies, and so from the standpoint, and it's when a person goes into a hospital or some other placement, and we don't pay for when the person isn't there, we support them with general fund money to kind of, because they still have to staff, they still have to keep the lights on and pay rent and all the things that they have to do, even when the person isn't there. And so from a provider standpoint, we completely understand that this, even though it isn't labeled a rate reduction, it feels in a lot of ways like a rate reduction. And with this one, I would also say, while it is on our list, it will impact some. It's not like an across-the-board reduction for providers. It will impact some providers, those that serve people with higher medical needs, more behavioral challenges, people who are, for various reasons, out of the home more. It will affect those providers more than it might affect others. So this is on the table. It's something we're, we put on the table to get to our reduction list numbers, but we understand the challenges behind that.
So let me ask a question
there.
Do you anticipate that there will be more people who will drop serving this population because this will become a bigger hole in their budget?
Chair Kinigeyer, I think that's a good question. If this goes forward and other discussions that are happening around DSP wage issues and training don't move forward, then I absolutely see that happening. I would also suggest that part of our discussion when we put this with the governor's office, when we put this reduction on the list, was that if this doesn't go away, we're in the process of setting new rates for providers. We can build in vacancy and other factors into the rate, and we can turn this money into part of their Medicaid rate, which then increases what it is because we add to it the Medicaid match. So they wouldn't bill specifically for bed hold anymore, but that assumption would be built into a rate, and we would, bring down the 65 to 70% match for this 100% general fund money right now.
Well,
so those are
solution.
All those are all the discussions we've
solution.
Had around that.
Okay.
The last one on the list, we have regional programs that were developed with, again, the Fairview closures, Staley settlement, all that happened in the Oregon DD system around that time. They were built as a way for local communities, counties, CDDPs, and people in the DD system to use a resource to shape what they needed in that area for them. Many of them offer training. The one thing they all do consistently is they help us with our crisis triage and crisis placements, and right now that's a huge issue, especially both children and adults. We have a number of children waiting to receive services who need a placement in a group home or in a higher level of care. We have a number of adults faced with the same situation. These regions options help us triage that piece. So what's on the table is cutting the funding for those regions, and then ultimately, of course, we have workload models now for CDPs and brokerages, and then we're proposing reducing the funding or the equity in that model, which will put strain on them in terms of handling. If both regions and we reduce equity, it puts more strain on them to handle what's in their system. So none of these cuts, none of the cuts for anywhere being suggested are good. That obviously remains true for the DD system.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
So Chair Kinnegaier, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez, I'm going to ask Trina Lee, who's Director of our Vocational Rehabilitation Program, to come up next.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Representative Kinnegaier and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trina Lee, and I am the Director for Vocational Rehabilitation. And just to remind folks, when you take a look at individuals that are working age within Oregon, there's approximately 350,000 Oregonians with disabilities of working age. Each year, vocational rehabilitation, we serve approximately 16,000 Oregonians, and that includes a little over 4,000 youth and students. And our services are very person-centered. It really depends upon the individual's impediment to employment and the services they need to get actively engaged. So we wanted to remind the committee that, you know, we're here to assist the Oregonians with disabilities to achieve, maintain, and advance in employment and independence. So the framework is laid out, and remember, vocational rehabilitation is the smallest of the five DHS programs. We're the 1%, the little smallest slice of the pie. And the framework includes a reduction of a total of $10 million, a little bit more than $10 million. Of course, there's three different layers of that, and I'm going to get into that right now. So first and foremost, and I'm going to kind of do these a little bit out of order, and there may be some additional questions, and I completely understand. First of all, if the recommendations are accepted, there will be a 5% reduction in client services, which means that we will serve approximately almost 2,000 people less than we're able to serve currently. The next layer is a reduction of services and a reduction of staff. And so with that 2% of reduction on both the staff side and services, that's going to raise that number of individuals that we won't be able to serve to almost 3,000. And I'll talk about the backfill, the one-time monies, in just a moment. But those two actions, I recognize that this committee has a lot of really tough decisions to make, and so, you know, we're here obviously to let you know what the impact of those decisions might be, and then the decisions will lay in your hands. Unfortunately, we are at a place within vocational rehabilitation is that if we have a reduction in staff and not able to meet the needs of the people that we know that are going to be coming through our doors, or we don't have enough money to serve them, or we don't have enough resources, one of those three areas could push us into what we call the order of selection, which is a waiting list. And with these two level of reductions, it's unfortunately going to do that. And so that has a huge impact on the DD program. With Director Tennedy, who was just here, there will be a cost shift over to that program because we won't necessarily be able to serve all the individuals under the Lane v. Brown settlement agreement. The order of selection is a really interesting and unique opportunity. I'll say opportunity. And it is imposed by our federal partners, by the Rehab Service Agency, RSA. And it requires us, if we have the funds, to serve the most significantly disabled individuals first, and then significant disabilities, and then the rest of the population. And it really depends upon a lot of variables. For example, if a state feels like they see their forecast and they don't believe that they're able to serve all of the priority number one, then they have to close all categories. Currently, the state of Montana is not serving any new individuals at this point. And then you take a look at your forecasting and the funds that you know that you have to be able to serve the individuals. And then what, and I'm sorry, I'm stumbling with my words here a little bit. folks can still come in to be determined eligible, but they just don't get into plan. And so they're in that holding pattern, and that's where the wait list happens. And then once a person is successfully off of our programs or leaves our programs, then the next people on the list come in. It's a statewide program, and so you can't necessarily look at your, well, for example, Washington County, one of our largest offices, have a high number of cases. However, the person on the waiting list might come from some other place in the state. So, I mean, it lends a lot of challenges to manage. The final thing I want to talk about, and then I'll pause and see if there's any questions, is each year the states have an opportunity to ask for what we call reallotment dollars, because many times there are states across the nation who don't have enough state funds to draw down all of their federal dollars, and they leave dollars on the table, or they're just simply not able to spend the dollars that have been allotted, and they return them. And then each year, RSA, our federal partner, asks states, if you have additional funds to be able to draw down, would you be interested in getting more federal funds? Oregon has done a really good job of asking for additional funds in the last couple of years, reallotment dollars. And so in the budgeting process, there was a backfill of general fund because last year we did receive reallotment dollars. And so if that entire amount is not or is taken as the framework, it potentially would put us at risk of asking for future federal dollars. So, I mean, it's a little bit different than the actual client service dollars. That top bullet point will not necessarily put us in the order. It's the other two things that will. So let me pause and see if I've completely confused you.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question about the order of selection. First of all, have we been there before?
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Chair Kinigeyer and Representative Sanchez. Yes, we have been in the order before. We were in the order of selection from 2008 until 2010, of which there were periods of time that we, just like Montana, we were not serving anybody for a while. With the assistance of the ARRA funds through the federal government, we were able to open and serve all categories. However, we stayed in the order, but we just were serving all categories. It wasn't until a little over a year ago, after the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act's final regulations came out, and there were some additional decisions that each state had to make, that RSA contacted us and said, okay, Oregon, you guys are technically in the order, but you're serving all populations and you've been in that status for 6 years. You're not really in the order. Mm-hmm. And so they took us out of the order completely. But because of that federal stimulus monies, we were able to serve all populations back in 2010. Now, of course, we had the Great Recession that happened, and that also impacted the individuals coming in and the placements, and so it really slowed things down.
Right. So I have a vague memory of trying to get people in back in 2008, 2009, and I'm not remembering how long it kind of took early on in that process. Because, I mean, how long was somebody sitting on a waiting list, possibly?
Chair Kinigeyer, thank you for the question. Representative Sanchez, it really depended upon the individual where they came into the process. I know that there was at least a six-month period of time that we weren't serving any new individuals. And so just to give you a really quick explanation, if Director Psyche and I were both coming in, and if he had more significant disabilities than myself, and if we came in on the same day, our application date is very important. If we're serving priority number one, we're in my example, Director Psyche would be a priority one. Then once a spot opened, he would be served, but I would have to wait until all the priority ones were completed and we could see that we had enough funding to be able to serve the priority twos. So my experience is going to be significantly different than Director Psyche's.
Right.
Sorry, you're priority
one. I have a question. There are two questions that are related. One is, what is the average duration that somebody's in your program? Because you said people cycle in and out. And then related to that, how do you use a reallotment of funds when it's a short-term and not a roll-up situation necessarily? Mm-hmm. So it's related to the duration, because you can't take on a lot of people using reallotment funds if it's not a roll-up.
Chair Kinigeyer, Excellent questions. And so first of all, because, and you hit exactly, because it's a person-centered approach, it really depends. And so we look at averages, and it can be, you know, we have cases where individuals are only with us a few months, and then we have other cases where people are there for years and years. And so depending upon the type of disability and the type of services, but usually we're looking at an 18-month, I mean, and that is really, really a high-level average. For individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, it's about 24 months, and students are somewhere in the middle, I believe. And I will need to confirm that and double-check. In regards to how reallotment funds are utilized, they are federal funds, and they're supposed to go back into utilizing for client service dollars. And it goes to the front of the line, basically, because we, depending upon when we purchase the services and the phase of the dollars, because we are allowed to have some carryover dollars from year to year. And let me give you another analogy. I'm a queen of analogies. Our budgeting process is as if it's like a chess game, but it's a chess game with five chess boards stacked and a Rubik's Cube around the outside. So if you make an adjustment up here, it has all kinds of adjustments down here, and then you're sliding things around as you would in a Rubik's Cube. So it's incredibly complex. And so I know I'm not doing a very good job of explaining the complexities, but we can certainly take some conversation offline if necessary.
Okay. And the other question I had was, how much overlap is there with the IDD division?
Talk about Lynn V. Brown.
Okay, excellent. Chair Kinigeyer, that's an excellent conversation or question. When we take a look at the demographics of all the individuals we serve, it really depends upon who comes through the door. Right now, there are about 30 to 31% of individuals that we're serving currently have intellectual and developmental disabilities. So there's that. What we do currently with Director Tennedy's staff and their contractors, of course, is they do different aspects of the process. So there's a discovery process, which is a Medicaid service, and they are able to get that service through the brokerages and CDDPs. And then once an individual is needing job development, that's when they come to us. And so in a perfect world, we are involved a little bit along the way, so we know the handoff can be as warm and as easy as possible, and our attempt is to wrap services around the individual. So once job development services are occurring, once a person obtains a job that fits their goal and they've reached stability, which is 90 days, then we close the case, and then the case, if they need long-term services, of which this population usually does need some sort of job coaching in the future, then eventually it goes back over to the DD program to do the long-term supports. So it's a handoff. Okay. And did you want me to hit any more of the Lane versus Brown?
No, I think we're
okay.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. So next I'm going to ask Kim Fredlin, who's director of our self-sufficiency programs, to join us.
Good morning, Chair Kinigeyer, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim Fredlund, and I'm the Director of the Self-Sufficiency Programs. I want to first start by just talking a bit about self-sufficiency and who we serve. So in last 2016, we served 1.2 million individuals over the year. Predominantly, that was in our SNAP program, but we also have our other programs in the safety net, our TANF program and our employment-related daycare program. And that 1.2 million individuals doesn't mean that everyone received services throughout the 12 months. We have lots of families and individuals who come in for a short time and then leave the programs. So the self-sufficiency programs really provide three key supports in Oregon. One is a safety net for families who are experiencing a financial crisis, family stability, which is really about helping that family stabilize and get back on their feet so that we can then work with them on connecting them to careers. And I think that connection to careers is really where our emphasis has been over this past year and really is where we're looking towards the future. What we've seen in Oregon occur in the economy is that as jobs have come back to the economy since the recession, there are a lot more part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, and families are not able to make it. And then on the other end of the job scale, there are higher-wage jobs that need more technical skills in order to obtain those jobs. And so our goal is really about how can we get the families that we serve those skills so that they can compete for those higher wage family wage jobs. So the self-sufficiency programs, So the reductions based on the co-chair's reduction list is a little over $84 million, which represents a little above 29% cut from the programs. And so I'll talk a little bit about specifically what those are. So in the two categories, I mentioned that SNAP is predominantly the largest program that we have, and SNAP is a federally funded program, except for some state funds around the administration of the program. And so the options for reductions really are going to come from the TANF program and from the employment-related daycare program. And so just to give you a little context, so TANF serves about 23,000 families currently, and the families have to be at or below 37% of poverty in order to qualify for that program. So we are talking about families who are deeply poor. Many of them are not working at the time that they come in. If they are working, they have to be working less than 2 days a week at minimum wage in order to still qualify for that program. So it's really families that are deeply poor. So the reductions that are proposed are a change to the time limits. So families are time limited on TANF. The change would be that adults would not be able to be on TANF after 48 months. And so if we were to implement that change, that would affect 3,952 families over this next biennium. We also, one of the changes is right now there's a time limit of 60 months, which means that a family, if they have some exceptional circumstances, then the children can still receive assistance while the parents are getting some sort of job training or family stability services like I talked about. The reduction here would also eliminate children's ability to get TANF at 60 months, and that would affect 970 families.
So children couldn't go beyond 60 months, you mean?
Correct. So the next reduction in TANF is counting Social Security income. Currently, a child or an adult who receives Social Security is not part of that TANF household. And so if looking at counting 50% of that SSI as income, that would affect 3,092 families. That means about 95% of those TANF families would no longer be eligible for TANF. The next reduction is for families where they're caring for children not their own, such as grandparents or aunts and uncles who are caring for children. Currently, there is an income limit for those families at 130%. The change in this reduction would actually have the income counted the same way we count any TANF family's income, meaning that 68% of those families would no longer be eligible for the program, and that number is 729. So the next set of reductions are really around the employment-related daycare. Again, employment-related daycare is a subsidy program for families who are working to help them pay for their child care. There are two reductions that would be 500 cases each per month for a total of 1,000 families per month less that we would be able to serve, which would mean the average capped caseload would be at 6,762 over the coming biennium. It's right now it's at 7,762, and we currently have about 8,100 families receiving that program. Okay. So the next reduction for ER... Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you remind us, because in 2015, I think it was, we changed the exit eligibility for ERDC. And so can you give us a comparison of 2015, what we went up and where that is compared to what this reduction would leave us at?
Chair,
as far as caseload-wise.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark. So for the ERDC program, the investment in ERDC last biennium was around expanding the number of the budget, which expanded the number of families. I don't have off the top of my head the number that equated to. So I'm sorry. I would have to get back to you on. I don't have it in my head.
Because Madam Chair, you might remember because we worked on this as well. Mm-hmm. If I recall, this is pretty close to undoing what we did in 2015, numbers-wise.
Yes. Chair Kenigaya, I would agree with that.
And so I'm just trying to write everything you were saying down. You're saying now the caseload is set at 7,762, but we're actually up at 8,100. We're over the caseload that we're allocated for. And this... budget reduction would bring us down to 6,762, which would be the lowest in many, many, many years, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, the way the program is currently structured is the program has periods of the program is open accepting applications and the program is closed not accepting applications. And so because of the way the program is budget capped at a certain number, we are constantly adjusting, shooting above the number, coming back down to the number because we can never keep it right on that number.
And you can't kick people off once they're...
Well, right. We would not want to kick people right. off while they're on it. And so we fluctuate that on and off of the program throughout the biennium to really come in as close to that caseload budget cap as we can.
Okay. And you had talked about two different ways of bringing it down by 500 families, and I didn't catch what are the two different ways that you intend to do that?
Chair Kenny Geyer, the two that I was referring to is in the co-chair's budget. There are two separate reductions of 500 cases equals a little over 8 million each, and that would equal about 500 families each. And so how we would get down to that number is through attrition in the year. Mm-hmm. And so we would watch the budget and the projections. We would not actually have people leaving the caseload when this passed. It would be throughout the biennium.
You're not changing any of the policies that we did, which allows them to come in at 185% and exit at 250% of...
That's correct.
...federal poverty limit. Okay.
Representative Stark first.
Thank you. So that same bill, I can't remember the bill number. I can
2015.
Thank you. In 2015, was 2015?
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's a priority.
Leave it to the speaker. Well done. So
I think that's true.
In Section 5 of that bill, there's reference to doing some sort of a study and reporting back to the legislature on whether or not the quality incentives, because we were looking at paying different if the provider had a different amount, and we were going to take a look at whether or not that had a negative impact on families using relatives as opposed to agencies. Have we had a chance to receive that report back?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, I do not believe that that report has been completed and submitted. What I can tell you about what is happening with the provider world around employment-related daycare is that while there were changes in 2015 around incentives, there were also changes at the federal level around increased requirements for providers when they're enrolling to become a provider. And so that's a combination combination of background check and fingerprinting, as well as increased amount of training that a provider needs to engage in before they're able to do care. What we've experienced from those changes is that we've seen a reduction in providers each month since that those changes have gone into effect, and they're much more dramatic in the what we would call the friends, family, and neighbor types of providers. And we see that, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is that those individuals tend to provide care for a shorter period of time, 3 to 6 months. They're helping somebody out, and they're just not interested in doing all of those things to for a short-term kind of engagement.
Thank you.
Okay. So
thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. Ms. Fredlin, thank you so much for this information. And it, I know that we're facing major cuts. It seems counterintuitive or productive to eliminate these funds for folks that are trying to get out of the hole, get out of poverty. And to me, when we're looking at trying to help folks, we should be pouring more money into programs like this, because it's through work and these folks learning better skills that they're able to build a better life. Mike, one of my questions to you was the folks that are you're trying to get into careers, and we mentioned careers. Do you have any details or facts on what education level a lot of these, do they have high school diplomas? Any of them have any secondary schooling or GEDs? Because some of my concerns here at the state level we're all working on right now is that because we have disinvested in education over the years, that our families aren't getting the education that they deserve and need to really have a quality life. And my question, do you have any details on the current level of education that these folks are have to start with? Because getting them to some kind of career with a GED is going to be difficult, and I'm just curious of, you know, maybe a different path we need to help these folks.
Chair Kinnegayer and Representative Meek, I appreciate the question. We really find that the families and individuals that are coming in are really across the board. Some of them do not have a high school diploma or a GED. Some of them have a high school diploma. Some of them have some college. Some of them have a degree. It really kind of depends on what the crisis was that brought them into us. And I think that the challenge, we absolutely agree that we've got to invest in educational opportunities or skill building. And I think where the challenge is that families that, especially in the TANF program only helps with a little bit of money. It is not enough to really survive on. So what happens is that people aren't able to survive long term and go to school long term in that program. And so we really are looking for opportunities of stackable credentials, career path programs through the community colleges, technical training, so that they can start on a career path, and then as they get that first job, that we really want to be there to help them get the second job and the third job and really progress, because we're really looking at when families get out of poverty and leave us entirely, are they really better off long term? And that's the goals that we have. So we're with them all along that path.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Mrs. Trott.
And one last question. Do you have any, do you lose any federal match by making these reductions?
Chair Kinnegayer, it's a great question that we've been wrestling with for a bit. So in ERDC, we would not lose any federal match at this point. In the TANF program, the answer is a little more complicated, because how the federal TANF block grant works is that there's a set amount the state needs to invest for the block grant itself, and then there's an even higher amount the state needs to invest in order to draw down what's called contingency fund, which we have been receiving contingency money from the federal government for as long as I can remember. And it is part of that structure of the budget. With these reductions, options and with the caseload reduction that we've seen, because we have seen people going to work, we are dangerously close to even the first level of being able to invest enough to meet that first level for the block grant.
So dangerously close to that and almost certain to lose the contingency funds?
Correct.
Under this budget?
Correct.
And how much would that be? How much are the contingency funds?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, the contingency funds fluctuate every federal fiscal year based on how many other states apply, but it's somewhere in the $16, $17 million range.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
I just want to offer up the final reduction is in ERDC, the incentive payments for providers, which Representative Stark asked about, would be one of the reductions in the program.
And that's incentive around quality?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
You know, Kim, I appreciate your presentation. One area that you haven't even touched on, we've constantly had problems and battles with, I don't hear much about it anymore, deals with the fraud investigative unit, the fraud that's occurred as a result of what's happened with the trail cards over the years. And it just doesn't seem to be on the front lines like it was here 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So I know we moved a bill, and you had some folks that were really helpful in doing something different with the trail card. Could you kind of talk about that? And also, could you talk to me about how many investigators you have now? Because we really tried 2 years ago to get more of those for you as well.
Chair Kinney-Geyer and Vice Chair Olson, our efforts have not stopped around program integrity. Program integrity is really one of the founding principles of the programs that we operate, because we want to make sure that the investment you guys are investing in us is used to the best of its ability. We have not seen a reduction in the investigator pool. We still conduct those. We've had, if you can call them success, I'll use that word lightly, based on some of the changes that were made around looking at data and really investigating from a more electronic means. We have actually had some instances over the last biennium where we were able to stop an ongoing fraud, and that typically has been at a retailer level, where you have retailers who are exchanging the benefits for cash, and so we definitely it's high on our mind, even if we haven't talked a lot about it this session.
So I'm just, Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that since it's not been out in front in the media and the news like it had been years ago, it's must be decreasing then. Or they're smarter and we've gotten dumber or something.
Chair,
that may be true for you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer and Vice Chair Olson.
Don't say it. That's okay.
Yeah, lots of words.
I would say, I would give us a more than passing grade. I think that we have looked at lots of alternatives to really make sure program integrity is important. It's one of our principles. It's one of the things, again, we pay attention to every single day. I think that we've definitely seen, especially over this last biennium, a really large increase in the amount of engagement and contact that we have with families. So we deeply understand what's going on in those households. And I think when we're that involved with people's situation, information, it's easier to come to light.
So Chair Kinney-Geyer and Vice Chair Olson and Sanchez, I think one of the things Kim pointed out, which I think the unit has really tried to do, is do a little more data mining. And so I think one of the reasons I've seen kind of a decrease in the real big money, high profile ones, and those are the ones that usually make the media. I think the last one I saw was about just after I started with a retailer up in Portland. But, there are individual cases of fraud, but not the $200,000 variety.
Well, and I just, for those who weren't here a few years ago and know what what the TANF program went through, I want to emphasize something that you said, which is the deeper involvement and more case management in the program. So there was a period when, during the recession, when we had to cut this program back tremendously. This actually goes before my time, too, but you were here, where the decision was made to really cut back on the case management piece of it and just get payments out to people, to keep people in those years, 2009, 2010, keep their heads above water. And so as the program has been able to reinvest over the last few years until this point, there was way more case management involvement with the families, recognizing that it wasn't just the dollars, but it was really helping connect people to job opportunities, training, those kinds of things that were going to help lift them out of poverty instead of just keep their head above water. So I would imagine that you know, if you have that kind of involvement with families, that they really genuinely are struggling.
Chair Kenny
Geyer, I'm guessing.
Yes. Okay. You're right.
That's my interpretation of what you said, knowing what happened in the last few years.
Yes.
And the rate of fraud, do you have a percentage rate that you estimate in the program?
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, it's the last percentage that I saw was 1% or less.
Mm-hmm. That's what I recall, that it's actually, it does get high profile, but in fact it's a very small percent of the program.
Yeah.
Way smaller than the cuts that we're looking
at. Yes.
37, I think you said, 37% cut in the self-sufficiency.
29.4.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, you wrote, you worked very hard on this.
Yes.
Vice Chair.
But I want to talk about something a little different, and I want to acknowledge, again, Kim's great work on so many things. And it's really difficult to talk about additions when we're talking about reductions. But I'm really happy that our TANF DV bill is still alive and down in Ways and Means. And that's, you know, that's our bill that for domestic violence victims and survivors, we can extend their time in TANF in order to become truly survivors. But Kim brought that to us and has done tremendous work around that. So, man, you can juggle them all. So I really appreciate what you do. So thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up, Rep. Peluso. And how much is that request for?
Chair Kenny Geyer, gosh, I
don't remember.
I want to... So the details on the request is that we would be able to work with survivors for 6 months during the engagement. It's currently 90 days. And we all know that a survivor fleeing a domestic violence situation is not going to become stable in 90 days. And so giving us a little more ability to work with them a little longer is good. We've also seen that program has not, it's the same amount that we're able to help someone with since the early 90s. That amount has not changed. And what we've seen in Oregon with the housing crisis is the $1,200 we're able to help someone with to get into safe housing just isn't enough to help them. And so we see around the same amount of people applying for the services and being eligible for the services, but they don't get a payment from us because it's just not enough to help them move in to a safe and stable housing. And so the request is for that to be bumped up to $3,000 in that time.
We'll see.
From 1,200 to 3,000.
Yes.
To help with housing and other related.
And stability.
Yeah.
Approximately 21 million. Our administrator just found out.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Now I'm going to ask Lena Al-Husseini, our Child Welfare Director, to join us.
And this will be the last program, the fifth program area. Last program.
Last but not least.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lena Al-Husseini, and I'm the Director of Child Welfare at DHS. DHS, Child Welfare, basically we work on keeping every child in Oregon safe and ideally at home when possible. And we also work on providing safe and appropriate placements for children statewide and supporting foster families when they do that. Sorry for my voice today, but our reduction is $31 million, which is 10.8%. And our critical reductions are the staff workload and screening position reduction, which are earned positions in the next biennium, and that will, the effect will be $6.1 million. and 54.5 FTEs. The impacts, of course, it will affect our capacity to serve and manage to serve the safety of children. It will contribute to the instability of child welfare workforce. As you all know, our turnover rate is around 30%, so we already have a problem with our retention. And it also impacts our ability to implement the statewide hotline by 75%. And this is the hotline we are committed to, but it would make it, instead of 24/7, we'd have to look at different ways, different shifts. How do we manage those cuts? And I can tell you also the 54.5 FTEs basically would touch or equal to the work of 205 protective service assessments, 345 ongoing permanency cases, 649 certified foster homes, and 370 adoption finalization. So these 54 staff would be touching all of these cases. The second point is the reduction in post-adoption services at 119,500. This is the general funds part from the, and it's matched by federal funds, and it would actually mean a cut of 771,000 nearly. And this, of course, provides the post-adoption services. It will impact 1,000 adoptive families. It would actually mean the closure of the post-adoption resource center and the Title IV-E compliance issues related to applicable child funds, which I've mentioned earlier. Our post-adoption services provide crisis intervention, advocacy, training, and support to the families of children who have achieved guardianship or adopted through the department. And these services promote family stability and prevent reentry into the child welfare system. Just for context, basically, we have at any one time 7,600 children in foster care. We have around 77,000 total child abuse neglect reports. We have 38,000 investigations completed. 7,677 of those were founded, around 20%. And we have 15,354 incidents of child abuse and neglect, just to show you the scope of our work. Thank you.
So this is an area that I know you're going to get to another slide with the governor's recommended increase.
Absolutely.
This, as a reminder to the committee, is the co-chair's framework,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
This is
yes.
Not recommendations that came necessarily out of you.
Well, so Chair Kinnegayer, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez, you know, as part of the budget build, we produced a budget 15% reduction list. The co-chairs used that, and it was a prioritized list that's been posted on our website for quite some time. The co-chairs used that as a starting point. They made some different choices than we did as far as priority. We spent the last 2 weeks meeting with the co-chairs individually by program area. Mm-hmm. And out of those discussions, I think we're looking at some other options. And, you know, it's an interesting discussion because the co-chairs are very invested in human services. And so the discussion is more like, well, we shouldn't cut that or you can't cut that. But reality is with a $285 million target, it's got to come from somewhere, and anything we take off the list will have to be replaced by another option. And so they've been really difficult discussions, but you know, the one thing I will share with you is that the co-chairs have really spent, I think, some quality time with our program directors, and we've had some really good discussions. So, you know, they've kind of done that deeper dive, at least with our programs.
I guess my question, and it's hard for me to know how much of this came out of your priority or any, you know, where, how the number landed at a 10% reduction in an area that we've continually focused on this committee, all of these areas. This is not to say anything about some of the other areas that Volk was 3%, something else was 34%, and it's all over the place. And so I know that what you put into that is how trying to minimize loss of federal funds. I look at $119,000, which is budget dust,
right.
And yet we're losing $750,000 federal dollars. That's like, where'd that come from? Right. So I'm just curious, and still a 10% reduction at a time where we're noted to be last in the country in foster care.
Right.
Is really hard for me to understand how we arrived. This is with all due respect to the people I serve with in this body, but how we arrive at that, if there's anything that you can help us understand.
So, you know, I do, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez, you know, we spent many, many hours looking at what potential reductions we could put on the table, and the danger, I think, of the exercise is you could certainly say we're struggling here, so let's not make as deep a cut. Let's make a deeper cut in the DD program or in self-sufficiency. But what happens then is then we put another system into crisis. You know, this is a really painful exercise. We spent hours arguing, trying to convince each other what the best course of action is, but you know, we approached it in a way where we tried to do the least amount of harm. We know we have certain mandated programs that we're going to have to provide the service, whether we choose to or not, or in some areas we don't have a choice. We have to provide this service. You know, I've been through budgets where we've been looking to make investments and budgets where we've had to make reductions. And it just, what I can tell you is that we try to make the best of a very difficult situation. None of the choices we have are good choices. You know, we look at things like how much federal funds do we leverage with this program. We look at things if this cut is made, will it impact not just the specific program the cut is made in, but will it impact other programs? You know, I would submit to you, when we look at our budget, the cuts that are being proposed in the Oregon Health Authority will have a big impact on our clients. When you look at cuts on the health plan and in mental health, it'll have a tremendous impact on us and you know, other agencies when you look at...
Which doesn't even show up here.
Yeah, it doesn't even show up here. So, you know, I don't have a good answer for you. I think, you know, I rely on my certified smart people, and we do the best we can, but there are no good answers. And if you ask me which cuts I would take, personally, I would say none of them. But that's not reality.
Okay, so next page is investments you would have liked to have had.
Yeah. So when we built the governor's recommended budget, again, to your point, I think, Chair Kenny Geyer, there are certain areas where the governor actually felt we needed to make investments in, and we were very supportive of that. And I will tell you, having been in the department for quite a while, I was allotted a lot more time with the governor than previous directors in budget discussions, and so I'm very appreciative of that. But those six bullet points are reductions that, to your point, we think are really investments that are really critical. The first one is, of course, right around child welfare. Rate increases for our behavioral rehabilitative services providers and foster care parents. We haven't had a rate increase for foster parents in 10 years, I believe. And then a really big part for us is supporting House Bill 2345, which would provide legal representation for our caseworkers in courts. In many hearings right now, everyone in the courtroom is represented except the DHS caseworker. And it's a very difficult situation, and I think at times doesn't result in the best outcome.
And contributes to the turnover.
What's that?
Probably contributes to the rapid turnover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and consistently when we talk to our staff out in the field, this is one of the issues that is brought up. And we've actually, during the past year, had one of our caseworkers who was unrepresented in court and was fairly new be cited for contempt by a judge. And I think it was... he didn't intend for that to happen, but being new and not understanding the complexities of the legal system, just kind of found himself in that situation. Mm-hmm. And the second piece, I think Director Tennedy talked about increase for direct service providers. You know, I think we're looking to make an investment here so we don't have the same kind of placement challenges that we have in the child welfare system. This is preventative, so we don't go there and then have to get into crisis in the DD system. Supporting the APD staffing level at 90.4% of workload. Again, you know, when you look at APD, we over the next 15 to 30 years, that's going to be kind of the growth industry, we think. And so we feel we need to be staffed at that level. Governor understood the importance of TANF, and so her budget funded it at 60 months and supported the reinvestment initiative. You know, very rarely do we put administrative investments in here, but our criminal background check unit does not just do background checks for DHS. They do background checks for the majority of our providers. And so right now, over time, we've added more and more providers that we're responsible for doing background checks for, and we also determine whether or not the person is can be employed. And right now, because we haven't added staff to this unit and have kept adding providers, it's a 60 to 90 day wait to get the check done, which means the person cannot start working until this check and employment decision is made. So this is an important one, not just for us internally, but for the provider community.
So I have a question on that one.
Sure.
So obviously, if you're adding more people, that brings in more revenue, but it's still falling farther and farther behind. So what percent of the fee they pay to do the background check covers the actual cost? And what would you have to increase it in order to fully fund itself?
Eric can correct me on this if I'm wrong. But my understanding at this point in time, Eric, is that we don't charge a fee. And that was a decision that was made at some point in time, that we were not going to charge providers. So we don't charge a fee to do the background check and employment, make the employment decision.
Okay. And what's the reasoning behind that?
This was a decision that was probably made five plus years ago.
Okay. Thank you.
So, and then finally, investments we have to make around two of our technology systems. The first is integrated eligibility, which would create a single eligibility determination system for Medicaid, TANF, SNAP, and ERDC. Right now, we have four or five different systems, and several of the systems on the self-sufficiency side are near end of life or quickly approaching end of life. And this is one of the ways I think we can also streamline service for clients, because we can take the core data and determine eligibility for all programs instead of them having to go and input the data into five or six different systems.
And how much would this cost? How much would that cost?
I'm trying to remember the exact amount. It's the funding for this would come through bond sales. It's not a general fund piece, and I think it's more than that, isn't it? No, about $45 million dollars worth of bonds. And it's a small portion in general fund. What was it, Eric?
$12 million
in general fund. And general fund was for debt service. Correct. And those type of things. And then in the aging with people with disabilities, a centralized abuse management system, which would really give us kind of a central system to track and manage abuse and gather data from all our different program areas there. So those are the kind of the six, we think, critical investment areas. And depending on the budget situation, I would tell you, as difficult as reductions are, we would look at some of these and consider whether we should make reductions in an area to fund some of these initiatives or some of these things.
Okay. And none of these are in the co-chair's budget
framework
right now?
No.
No new funding?
No.
Okay. Okay, questions?
from anyone. Questions? Comments?
Well, I mean... I'll
just invite Eric if you'd like to add anything, because I'm sure you're thinking of all the other little details as people are giving the high level.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would like to draw attention to, since you've been sitting so patiently?
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, co-chairs Olson and Sanchez, members of the committee. My name is Eric Moore. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services, and I think they've pretty well covered the majority of the major reductions that are in the list. There are some cross-the-board DHS actions in the co-chairs framework, like a 3% reduction in personal services, a 3% reduction in service and supply, that of course impact the entire agency and will impact these programs as well as our infrastructure in the budget. So we haven't talked greatly about those, but the major program reductions have been spoken about today.
And I have a question about Commission on the Blind. Any kind of interaction between the Commission on the Blind and DHS? I should have asked this when Trina was up there about
both, I think Ashley
rehab, but...
Okay, yes.
Sure. Oh,
that's right. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Lena. Thank you. So at that level or any other budget level and any efficiencies that could be found?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, I believe the question is the relationship with Commission for the Blind and Department of Human Services. Each state, when you're looking at rehabilitation services for voc rehab, every state has an opportunity to have a one agency, or they can split into a general agency and a blind. And in Oregon, the choice was made years ago that we would have two separate entities. And so we work very closely with the Commission for the Blind. Sometimes there's individuals that will have a occurrence of blindness, but then they'll potentially have other disabilities as well. And so there may be a time that we can co-manage a case, which the rehab service agency allows us to do. They are very small compared to, it's almost the same percentage, believe it or not, if we look at how small VR is compared to the DHS programs, when you compare Commission for the Blind to the VR General Agency, which is the general program, which is my program or our program. It's the same. And so we take a look at when an individual comes in, you know, which either agency or program is going to be able to better serve their needs. And because Commission for the Blind does do some independent living skills that we do not on our part, because we contract with the Centers for Independent Living to be able to do that. But we do share the same grant, and so our requirements and all of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act requirements apply to both entities. Does that make sense?
Thank you. And I'll just say for the record, one of the bills that we're considering right now is the Blind Enterprise Program. And we're trying to build into that incentives to hire people with disabilities, not only blind people, higher incentive for employing employees who are blind, but also some incentive built in for hiring people who have a range of disabilities, including, according to the ORS, it's pretty broad, including people with addictions, and also including veterans. But we're hoping that those programs work closely with you to find opportunities, because someone who's blind can't drive the vending machine materials to the vending machine, but they could hire somebody with a different kind of disability who could do that. And so we're hoping that those programs work well together.
So, Chair Kinney-Guire, really quickly, the beauty of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act requirements is that all entities and different core partners have to work together, and so we're not duplicating services across the entire workforce system, but that includes Department of Human Services, so self-sufficiency, vocational rehabilitation, Commission for the Blind, along with education, the workforce, the community colleges, et cetera, and so that you just hit the absolute essence of the act.
Mm-hmm. Great. Representative Noble,
do
you have a question?
Thank you, Chair. This is more for the director and comment for all the staff, because what you do is critical for our state and for people who we represent and work with and try to improve their lives. From a high level, it just seems consistently ironic with the other discussions going on in this building that we're talking about cuts in a time when really the co-chair's framework is still a 7.6% increase over the last biennium. So I maybe from a high level, and I apologize if you covered this because I was late, if you covered this early on, but what are the, from your perspective, the major cost drivers that would require a budget increase of 17.9% just to keep current service levels?
So, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Co-Chair Olson, and Sanchez, I'm Representative Noble, excuse me. I'm going to let Eric start on that, and then I'll follow up.
And just high level's fine. I don't need details.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
I can. it seems ironic that we're talking about cuts and reductions when we're talking about also a 7.6% increase over the last biennium with the framework. Current service levels looks like to keep those, it requires a 17.9% increase in the overall department budget. So I'm curious as to what the major cost drivers are.
Right. Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson and Sanchez, Representative Noble. I think the major cost drivers are really in the cost per case and the caseloads that are being driven in part by the K-Plan that we've implemented. And so the biggest drivers are the forecasted increase in caseloads and cost per case. There was also a large amount of one-time monies that were built into the budget that needed to be backfilled in the TANF and ERDC programs, where some one-time monies were used that also led to an increase in the general fund.
Follow up.
Yes.
So that's my question is really born is I hate to see these cuts. I think it's the wrong direction. It just seems like we're in a tough spot to have a 17.9% increase just to keep our current service level.
But it appears to me, I think that you had more graphs when the focus in the beginning, which I think was February 2nd, was more on the program and less on the budget. You, I believe, had graphs which show the demographics, and some of that is an aging population. And should have asked this of Ashley when she was up here, but I believe that our aging population is growing faster than many, many other states. And then, of course, the K-Plan eligibility, which we went out ahead of other states and increased that, made a decision to go with the bigger match, but with that came a bigger caseload, and we didn't know that was going to happen. And then it's a matter of having to pull that back once we got out, and we're one of the first to try that because we wanted to be able to include more people, more services, and didn't realize what the reaction. So that's how I remember a couple of the caseloads really expanding dramatically.
So Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Representative Noble, the one thing we're doing right now is we are going before the Ways and Means Committee with the latest caseload forecast looking forward. So once we finalize that, we'd be happy to share it with, we'll send it to Cassie to make sure that everybody in the committee can see what the trend lines are on the caseload.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for your service and for the informational hearing. And close the informational hearing, and we're adjourned. Adjourned. Informational hearing.